But I think there's also with the social media space that compare and despair. We're seeing these unattainable goals. And then even just like the beautiful food and stuff. Like my food doesn't look like that, right? Nobody's does unless you're an expert in food styling and editing and making it look so perfect. But we think, oh, my food should look like that, or my body should look like that. If I do this and that, I'll be just like this person. And it's just unattainable, unrealistic.
Nutrition advice is everywhere, from TikTok trends to podcast, influencers to headlines. But how do you know who to trust? In this episode of the Good Clean Nutrition Podcast, I'm joined by registered dietitian, diabetes educator, and friend, Melissa Joy Dobbins. Known for her Soundbites podcast and work in evidence-based communication, Melissa brings decades of expertise to a topic we're both passionate about, debunking food fear and misinformation. We explore the rise of distrust in health information, how to become a critical thinker when it comes to nutrition information, and why communicating science in soundbites is trickier than ever. Let's get into it. Before we begin to tackle all the health misinformation out there with Melissa, I want to share an example of a popular nutrition myth circulating currently. We need to cut all seed oils from our diet because they're toxic. Seed oils like canola, soybean, and sunflower have been getting a really bad rap online, but the science actually tells us a different story. These oils are rich in omega-6 fats, and some people claim that causes inflammation and that those oils are always rancid or damaged. In reality, these are actually unsaturated, heart-healthy fats, and actually, the normal balance for human diets is to have more omega-6 fatty acids than omega-3 fatty acids. And omega-3s come from salmon, sardines, walnuts, chia, hemp, and flax seeds, foods like that. That being said, a lot of people actually do not meet their needs for omega-3s. So that might be a place you need to focus. And I'd argue that it's not really the seed oil's fault. We need to be looking at balancing our diet by including a variety of types of fats. And of course, those fats should not be rancid or damaged, like from repeat frying or exposure to high heat. The bottom line here is that seed oils aren't the villain like they're being made out to be right now. Like everything else, it's about balance and context, what it means for you, what your diet is like, what your health goals are, and what kind of foods you have access to. Welcome, Melissa. It's a real joy to have you here today. For anyone who doesn't know, I had the pleasure of being a guest on your podcast. So today we're flipping the script, and I love working with you because you're a wealth of information and like balanced nutrition advice. So to start, can you introduce yourself and share where your passion for debunking health misinformation began?
Absolutely. So good to see you, Ginger. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. So I've been a registered dietitian nutritionist for over 30 years and certified diabetes care and education specialist for 27 years, which I'm super proud and excited about because it was a really hard certification to get. And I'm just so passionate about diabetes education, even though I don't spend a lot of my business on that right now. But anyway, so I have worked in hospital settings, clinical, outpatient, diabetes clinic, outpatient. And then in 2011, I started my own business in basically food and nutrition communications. I kind of call myself an accidental entrepreneur because I'm not like one of those people that was like, oh yeah, I want to be my own boss. I really had no goals for that, but it kind of happened to me. And when I decided to start my own business, I thought I've had all of this opportunity for media training and media experience. So I was fortunate in, I was also a state media rep for Illinois. And then around the time I started my own business, I was applied and accepted to be an academy spokesperson. So in those situations, you do get training, but most dietitians really don't have access to that or access to affordable training. So I thought, you know, this is something that I think I would enjoy training dietitians more than actually doing the media myself. And it was just seemed to be something that really resonated. I didn't know if it would flop or if it would take off, and it really resonated. And then, of course, I was still doing my own media interviews at the time. And in 2015, I thought, gee, I love radio. And I thought, well, a podcast is sort of like having your own radio show. So I started my Soundbites podcast back then, and it's been going, it'll be 10 years old in a couple of weeks. Hard to believe.
It's like one of the original nutrition podcasts, I feel like.
One of the first. Yeah. There was some before me, but yeah, even when I looked into it, I didn't understand what it was. So I'm really glad that I decided to try that. And that's one of the things that I tell dietitians is there's so many different ways to communicate. Try out different things. Maybe you prefer writing. Maybe you prefer speaking. Maybe you prefer social media. Just there's so many different options available today. So that's what I encourage people. But to your question about how I kind of first got interested in debunking misinformation, it really goes back to when I was a teenager, around 15 or 16 years old, I attended a performing arts high school for ballet. And I was so confused, a lot of mixed messages, just not even sort of like the strict dieting vibe, of course, is in that arena, but even just like what's good for you and what's not. And really back then, we didn't talk about fueling for performance.
Right.
So much has changed, which is good. But I just remember being confused and frustrated. And we didn't have social media back then, but we did have infomercials. And really kind of thought, people are really getting taken advantage of. And I don't like that. Their time, their money, their efforts. Every time somebody tries something, they're promised all of these results. And they try it and it doesn't work. Every time they get more and more discouraged. And that's really kind of what sparked me to say, I want to help people get the facts, make the decisions that are best for them, and make the most of their efforts so that they feel empowered. They're getting results. They're not being taken advantage of.
I love that you've built so much out of necessity. And I think that's where the biggest success comes. So like, it sounds like your passion for addressing fear of food and misinformation came from a really interesting experience that you had that sounds very unique. And I know that you love ballet and the arts, and I know you still do it, right?
Yes.
So amazing. And then also launching your business. I mean, I met you in 2011 or 2012. So we've known each other for a really long time in Chicago, and you just saw a gap. And then I am also lucky enough to have received training from you as a spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. So I think you and I are really lucky to have had a lot of official training and for me to have you as the trainer. But there's a really important point there that there's training. It's hard to debunk nutrition myths. Like, it requires a lot of communication skills, because if you just ask me point blank, like, what about this thing? We have this really deep knowledge of nutrition, but like translating it to like, what does it mean for you, the person that's asking the question, or how am I going to talk about it on social media to millions of people? Like, that part's really challenging.
Yes. And one of the biggest challenges we have as healthcare professionals is we have to be evidence-based. So the non-credentialed people, their voices can just drown us out because they can say whatever they want. They can be so compelling. And it's kind of hard when you're just talking about the science to be super compelling and stay accurate. So that's a big part of it. And then just, yeah, handling the different platforms. I know we're going to talk about social media a lot. There's just so many challenges inherent in different platforms, and how much time and real estate that we have to get our messages across.
Yeah, 100%. And you have created a really incredible platform. So you have Soundbites through your podcast, and you have your really amazing newsletter, and you're very focused on what you mentioned, like science-based nutrition, or we call it evidence-based nutrition, and debunking food fears. And personally, I feel like there's more fear and distrust about food right now than ever. So I'm really glad that we're talking about this. But I'm interested in what ways you see food fear impacting people, maybe that they don't even realize.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the distrust, and I pulled some information. Our friends over at the International Food Information Council, they do the annual food and health survey, and they also do various spotlight surveys on different topics. And they recently did a survey. And the good news is people are saying that their trusted sources are still medical professionals, registered dietitians, However, they're getting most of their information from other sources, not us credentialed professionals. And it just leaves them confused, frustrated, and full of doubt. So to your point, definitely trust and credibility is an issue. And one of the things that we offer as dietitians and healthcare professionals is benevolence. We truly are in the field to help people. And so that's one way that consumers can kind of identify credible information is, what is this person getting out of it? Are they selling something? Are they really just trying to help me? So that's one thing. But, you know, I think to answer your question about where I see food fears, where people may not even realize it, I think most of what people hear about nutrition is actually misinformation. And they don't even know it. And they don't even maybe even realize the fear-based information that they're hearing. So anything from don't trust the food industry, or certain foods or ingredients are not safe. That's I feel like that's mostly what people just hear all the time.
Yeah. And then like, what do you do and who do you trust? And then you're just doing your own research. And that's a huge reason that people reach out to me and you and all dietitians, I'm sure, and other allied health professionals is like, can you please tell me what this means for me? What is true and not true? Like, that's the best case scenario, is that somebody wants personalized information and wants it to come from someone that they know is not biased. Yeah. The food fear, I mean, it reminds me even of like, how it can lead to a slippery slope of disordered eating or fear of food, such as orthorexia is a term that I think is really important for people to understand, where you're so afraid of certain foods or ingredients that you cut. But a lot of times that leads to your own health problems, bone density issues, unintended weight loss, nutrient deficiencies. Like, I think the stakes might be bigger than people think they are.
Yes, especially those who are really just trying to be healthy and do the right thing.
Right.
It can be a slippery slope. And that's one of the things that really got me so excited about working with people with diabetes and pre-diabetes, is because there's even more, another layer of food fear for them, with just like, oh, I can't eat all of these foods or drink these beverages because of my blood sugars. And if I do, then those complications, right? That are so scary. So that's where I felt like, oh my gosh, this is an area where I can help people make little changes and really see big results right away. And I can really make a difference. So, and then all of the medications and the technology, everything in that space has just exploded. And the options are growing for people in the toolbox, like just like with obesity, it's exciting. And it's, like I said, the good news is that, like you said, people are interested, and yeah, best case scenario, they're questioning, wait, is this true or is this not true, instead of just taking things at face value.
I remember I was a very young dietitian. I had just kind of started maybe the first few years, and I was working in a really cool cancer center. And I had this man say to me, well, I mean, why would you ever suggest soy? Because obviously it's inflammatory and toxic. And my young dietitian self, I was like, I know that's not true, but I don't know quite how to answer it. Like, I didn't have my words yet, because I had the education, but I didn't know how to like explain it in a way that he needed in that moment. How do you handle pushback like that when you're trying to debunk a health myth?
I don't really perceive it, I guess, as pushback. Some of our colleagues have a recent paper published about misinformation and disinformation and the code of ethics. Connie Dickman and Cami Ryan, and I believe the third author is Tracy Oliver. And so that's a great resource. And she did a podcast interview with them on this. What they talk about is approaching somebody like that situation with questions, and not just, let me go right in and tell you why that's wrong, which it makes common sense. Some of that is like motivational interviewing techniques. So certainly when we're trying to help people, we need to realize that is not helpful, just coming in and saying, no, that's not true, and here's what's true. So what I do a lot of times is I try to listen more, and I try to find out what they're really afraid of, or what their concerns really are, or where they found the information, but not like, where did you hear that? Just, oh, I'm really curious. Where did you read that? Or tell me more about that. It's a relationship building opportunity. We need to communicate the uncertainties, because that is inherent in science and nutrition research. It's not black and white. And instead of kind of that, I felt sometimes like a broken record. Well, here's what we know now, but more research needs to be done, is to really communicate those uncertainties. Here's where the evidence is strong. Here's where it's moderate. Here's where it's weak. If we talk about that more, then people will realize that's normal and they'll be more comfortable with those uncertainties. So I think that's a really important point.
I know you and me are both very active on all sorts of different platforms, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. We've got this very short form content. So how do you approach communicating in a soundbite that's so short? Like, what role does that play in this conversation?
I think like when I did live TV, I might have 2.5 or 3 minutes. So I knew how to prepare for that, to make sure that there was still interaction between me and the host. And I wasn't just like, blah, 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 here's what you need to know. Having like your opening statement be very compelling, making sure you include a call to action. So there's like these formulaic things that can really help, whether it's a 30-second reel or an hour-long presentation. But one thing that I learned recently, there was a survey by MyFitnessPal. I saw this speaker at a conference. And so I've got some information that I wanted to share with you. I'll refer to this quite a bit because it's like an infographic on how to spot questionable nutrition tips, red flag alert, things like that I'll share in a minute. But they did this survey, and one of the things that they found, they surveyed TikTok. This is a TikTok survey. I won't get into all the details, but the takeaway for me was this short form content is very challenging for us to get into the science. Personally, my takeaway was it's almost impossible for us to share evidence-based information in a meaningful way in a 15, 30-second reel. However, one thing that you can do that was a huge takeaway for me was in the first 15 seconds, maybe the first thing you say is your credentials and your qualifications. Like, I'm Melissa Joy Dobbins. I'm a registered dietitian nutritionist. I have been a certified diabetes educator for 27 years. Then the people who know that we're credentialed, when we say that right off the bat, it makes them much more likely to go, oh, this person is qualified. So just a little tip there that I think is something easy that people can do. But ultimately, I just feel like something like YouTube or podcasts, where you have more time to really get into the science and the nuances, it's really hard to boil it down into tiny, teeny sound bites.
It's a really great point. I mean, if somebody comes to me, I had an amazing patient of mine come and ask about seed oils the other day. I know you're talking about this a lot too. And she was like, I heard this and I want to know from you. We must have spent 20 minutes talking about all the ins and outs and how it relates to her diet and where some of this misinformation is coming from and what it means to her. Like you said, soundbiting that in 10, 20, 30 seconds, it's almost impossible. And I feel like it does the nutrition advice a disservice almost.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And part of that is that individualized piece of it, because each person has different goals and priorities. So you're going to have to tailor it to, and that's one of the problems with communicating to the masses. Things can get lost in translation. Your message can get oversimplified because you kind of speak into everybody and not just to one person. But still, having some sort of a call to action can help with that a little bit. But it is challenging.
Yeah, because you can be like, give me a call. We'll discuss for more information. Or here's my newsletter. Or here's like a way you can learn more. Do you think that some of these platforms that have very short form content are actually spreading the misinformation? Like, what role does social media play?
I mean, there's the good and the bad. The good news is it's more of an opportunity for us to get our voices out there. The bad news is every other non-credentialed person has that opportunity as well. And it is, like I said earlier, they can say whatever they want, so they can be really compelling. So I think that it's not helpful for our field ultimately, but we still have to fight the good fight and try to get our messages out there. I think the way I use short form content is to promote my longer form content. So I'm glad that as a content creator, my sole focus isn't just what am I going to put on Instagram or TikTok. It's the podcast interviews that I do or the other media interviews that I do. And then I just share that little snippet and like to read this article, go here, or to listen to this podcast, go here. That's how I use it.
Yeah, I use it pretty similarly. There are some dietitians out there doing some incredible work making very entertaining, relevant short form content, especially on TikTok. So there's some interesting stuff going on out there, and really cheers to any healthcare providers that are in it in that way. It's awesome.
Absolutely.
This episode is brought to you by Orgain. Need a quick, easy way to stay energized? Orgain's 20 grams plant-based protein shake packs 20 grams of protein with no dairy, soy, or artificial sweeteners. With only 140 calories per serving and 0 grams of sugar, it's a delicious, satisfying fuel to power your day. Whether it's your morning commute, post-workout recovery, or an afternoon pick-me-up, this shake has you covered. Grab it in flavors like creamy chocolate. Head to Orgain.com to learn more. You mentioned before that we're kind of having this weight loss culture situation with a lot of new medications on the market and a lot of chatter about losing weight, changing the shape of your body. What can you say about how misinformation might be affecting the way people feel about their body, their relationship to food? Like, what's going on in that space?
I mentioned earlier, every time somebody tries something and fails, it's just, well, we know that with yo-yo dieting, like when you lose weight, you lose muscle and fat. And when you gain it, you just gain fat. And so then it messes up your metabolism and you're just worse and worse. But the same thing mentally, every time you try something and fail, you get more and more discouraged and more desperate. And we want people to be empowered and to feel good about their choices, whether it's food or fitness, and just have a better quality of life and meet their goals for health. And if their weight falls in line with that, great. I think we are talking more and more these days about weight does not equal health necessarily. Somebody can be overweight and still have good labs and good general health. Somebody could be thin and not be healthy. But I think there's also with the social media space that compare and despair. We're seeing these unattainable goals, and then even just like the beautiful food and stuff. Like my food doesn't look like that, right? Nobody's does unless you're an expert in food styling and editing and making it look so perfect. But we think, oh, my food should look like that, or my body should look like that. If I do this and that, I'll be just like this person. And it's just unattainable, unrealistic, and just depressing.
Yeah. And I know there's some research available about how it affects kids and teens, and that can be really challenging.
Yes.
I think the answer to this really is that so much online health advice is one size fits all. But as dietitians, I mean, one of our biggest specialty is personalizing advice. And I know a lot of other allied healthcare professionals do that too really well. How do you communicate the importance of tailoring dietary choices to individual needs?
I think that this is what worked for me, so it's going to work for you too, is a red flag. And I think it's, again, it's like one of those things that when you tell people you have individualized needs that are unique to you, and it's like they kind of are relieved to hear that, because I think they innately know that, but they think, well, okay, I got to try that. And I think one example is, like, especially with people with diabetes, they might hear, well, vegan or vegetarian is healthy, or more like paleo or high protein, low carb. Either end of that spectrum or in the middle could work for somebody with diabetes. If they like more vegetables and less protein and less meat, and that's kind of their preferences, I say, let's start there. If they say, well, my blood sugars are still a little high, maybe I want to try to cut back on some of the carbohydrates, still in a moderate way, but and just maybe increase some of my proteins, then we can kind of make that shift and see how that's working for them. Some people do great with a higher protein, low carb. Other people are like, no way, that's just not the foods that I like, and it would be really hard. And so I think that message that, what are your preferences? What can you stick with long term? Let's tweak that instead of flip-flopping it and doing something dramatic the other way.
There's the people's lifestyle too. I mean, I've been working with a lot of patients lately, and they were like in the middle of sports season at school, and they're like, I'm super busy all day and I'm working. And then starting from 5 to 8 p.m., I'm driving multiple children around the city for different sports events. And they're like, but I want to like cook more. I want to work out more. And I'm like, how are we going to do this? We have to figure it out together because we have to think about this person's individual situation and the challenges. You mentioned red flags, and I want to talk about red flags. So whatever I do is perfect, you should do it. That's one. We see a lot of that. What else is a red flag for you?
Like I said, the MyFitnessPal survey, there's five that I'll list out. Extreme dietary or nutritional claims. If it sounds too good to be true, maybe question it. Simplistic science. If something's oversimplified, even some people who are, they mean well, like eat less, move more. To me, I'm like, how meaningful is that? What does that really mean for a person? It's a little oversimplified. An overemphasis or reliance on supplements and vitamins. That's like, we do want to do food first, and there's definitely a role for supplements and vitamins, absolutely, but not like, oh, here's like, that's the big focus, right? The one size fits all approach that we've been talking about, that's a red flag. And really, this is a big one, deviation from established dietary guidelines. So anything that's cutting out an entire food group or that says this is all bad and kind of turning it upside down and being like, you should do the opposite. When you see all these reels or ads or whatever, like, what's the one food you should never eat? It's like, how about food that's spoiled?
I love it. I love it. It's good advice.
Yeah. So those are five red flags. Oh, there's some trigger phrases to watch for also.
Ooh, yeah.
The secret doctors won't tell you.
Yes.
Hate that one. Fun fact, I was an expert witness on a Federal Trade Commission trial for an infomercial king, and his book was The Weight Loss Secrets They Don't Want You to Know. So, the secrets the doctors won't tell you. This was over 10 years ago. He wrote this book, and you could say whatever you want in a book, but in his infomercials and his videos, he was saying, you can eat pizza, you can eat ice cream, you can do all these things. But in his book, it was like 500 calories, no frills, a lot of supplements. There was even HCG injections, things like that. So he was misrepresenting his book. So it was a FTC fraud type case and a mail fraud type case as well. And he went to jail for 10 years.
That is really
wild. He's out now. So.
Oh no, be careful. There are some diet trends though that are... Some are backed by science, some are not. There's a lot circulating on the internet. What trends do you see creating this fear and misinformation?
Well, you mentioned the seed oils. Also, ultra-processed foods are the villain of the day, and similar to seed oils, they're kind of a little misunderstood. And I don't think either one of those issues is going away anytime soon. But it's an opportunity to talk about, well, here's what the science shows. And this is where it might be getting conflated. Like, ultra-processed food could be chips, indulgent foods, let's just say, right? But according to the NOVA classification system, soy milk is an ultra-processed food. Plant-based burgers are ultra-processed. Whole wheat bread is ultra-processed. Some yogurts. Like, let's look at the food and the nutrition it provides. And yes, there are some issues like hyperpalatability. Okay, we do need to kind of dig a little bit deeper than the nutrition itself. And I would say the nutrition is the bulk of it, but there might be some other issues. Like if a food is hyperpalatable, it's going to be consumed faster and you could get more calories and that could be an issue. We know that we're getting more calories today than we used to. Is it because of addictive foods and the food industry is evil? No, we like our food to taste good. We want that chocolate to melt in our mouth. We want that chip to be crispy and crunchy. It's just, we are eating more. And what are the causes of that? We're eating more of everything. We're eating more nutritious foods. We're eating more indulgent foods. And we're more sedentary.
A lot of our colleagues, dietitians, and other allied health professionals are interested in publishing or sharing their research on social media, but they're not quite sure how to do it in a soundbite. What are your top three pieces of advice for like how to get into that or how to share information even in short form?
It's hard. We've been talking about the challenges in that, especially with the short form content. I would put together something in a longer form, like a video or an article or a podcast or something, and then use like TikTok or Instagram or whatever to point to that and say, hey, here are the highlights. A lot of times a good way to do it is, did you know? And then answer it, getting people's attention, like kind of redefining reality or thinking about something differently. I think for me, that's always very compelling because I think there's so many opportunities there. You hear this all the time, but the truth is actually the opposite. And then say, if you're interested in that and you want to hear more, go to this article, video, podcast, making sure that you're sharing your credentials and your background in the first few seconds. And yeah, just being consistently putting stuff out that's proactive. I mean, that's not specific to that question, but I think that's the other piece that I think as dietitians, we tend to not see the value in kind of talking about some of those evergreen topics that need to be out there. But the truth is, when somebody has a question on that topic and they go looking for credible information, we want to be sure there's a lot of credible information there. This is something that we learned years ago when the vaccines and autism sort of myth popped up, partly due to the fact that there was that paper that was, I think, rescinded or retracted. There was some serious problems with that study. The horse is out of the barn, sort of a situation. And when people had questions about are vaccines causing autism, the mainstream medical community knew that wasn't an issue. So they didn't really say much. But when people went online, there was a few credible sites that they found, but a lot of misinformation. So that's one example of why it's just so important that dietitians just talk about fiber, talk about fruits and vegetables, talk about macros, talk about micros, just like stuff that people need to know. And then when they have questions, they'll find it.
It's a great example. For anyone feeling overwhelmed by misinformation online, that's probably everybody. What strategies do you recommend for improving digital health literacy and just cutting through some of that noise?
Yes, well, there's always limiting your time on social media. And one of the things that I learned from that MyFitnessPal survey was maybe we should view social media as entertainment and not where we necessarily get educated. Or even just kind of having that in the back of our minds that this is more of an entertainment type thing. There might be some nuggets of kernels of truth here or whatever, but to look for more of those credible sources. There are organizations that have like the scientific summaries and everything, like here's the research to date on this or that topic that is available to us. So we might need to kind of take a step back and say, oh, where is the best place for me to get the answers to my questions? And
sure,
it's easy to just Google, but then make sure you're looking at what are the sources. And also, like, sometimes there's like hidden agendas. It's a whole other topic for another podcast probably, but you know, like, again, it goes back to our concept of we have the code of ethics and we have benevolence. What are these other people? What are their hidden agendas? So maybe sometimes not so hidden.
Yeah, if we're doing disclosure. Yeah, it's great advice, Melissa. And I hope that people do reach out to credentialed healthcare providers to be their go-to as far as myth busting and providing clarity and also a level of personalization that I'm glad you brought up kind of can't be shared correctly, especially in short form content. Well, I'm excited to continue the discussion in our next episode, which is how to find reliable health information in a digital world. So lots more exploration about what to do, who to trust, and how to cut through the noise. Today's conversation is a powerful reminder about how food fear often begins in subtle ways and how misinformation can chip away at our confidence over time. Whether it's a viral headline, a fear-based social media post, or an influencer selling a one-size-fits-all solution, the noise out there can be overwhelming. But the solution is credible, evidence-based advice, and experts like Melissa and I are leading the charge. I hope this episode helps you feel a little more grounded and empowered in your food choices. But we're just getting started. In part two of our conversation, Melissa and I dig into how to spot red flags online, the truth about trending diets, and how to personalize your nutrition. See you there.